Accession number 10589, Reel 4.
Mr. Gillard, Reel 4.
The BBC had very few seasoned war reporters. There was Godfrey Talbot, who was going to remain out there and take over the whole Mediterranean area. Somebody had to do that. There was Richard Dimbleby and myself. There was a man called Dennis Johnson, who was not really a newsman. He was a features and documentary man. And he didn't really come much into the picture at any time, actually. Though he was very good at his particular job. But he was not a newsman. But that was the lot. I can't think of anybody else we had who was really seasoned and experienced. This wasn't altogether the BBC's fault. You see, the public relations branch of the army had insisted throughout, up to that point, on regarding the BBC as just another newspaper. And so allocations of war correspondent seats, so to speak, of war correspondent assignments, were all made on that basis. And for instance, when I covered the Dieppe landing, I was there on my own. I didn't even have an engineer with me. And in North Africa, as I was saying, there were just two of us. We had one engineer there as well. And so there was no opportunity, really, to give other people the opportunity, the chance of getting any training, any experience of war reporting. At the same time, the BBC had by now realised that the way in which it covered the operations in Northwest Europe when the landings took place in France would really govern its reputation for decades ahead. It must be properly and thoroughly done. And was very anxious indeed, therefore, that its correspondents, the people who were going to be doing the reporting, should be properly trained. By now, and this is largely due to Montgomery, who had a concept of the value of war reporting that no other top general in our command, in the British command, anywhere, had at all. The American generals had it, but Monty was the only British general who, as he put it in his own language, regarded broadcast coverage as an arm of warfare. He used to say to me, the most important factor in war is the morale of the troops. The way in which their activities are reported to the world is the biggest stimulus to their morale. If war reporting is properly conducted, the troops can get to know their leaders. I want the troops to know me. I want them to know what I'm planning, what I'm going to do, what I want them to do, and I want them to have trust and confidence in me. And if they think that I am asking them to do something that is within their power, they will jolly well go and do it. And I, therefore, every time you come to me with a microphone, I'm only too happy to speak, because I know I'm speaking to every soldier in my army, and I'm not an unfamiliar figure sitting way back a few hundred miles comfortably behind the front directing the operations. I'm up there with them, I'm one of them, I know what's going on, and they can hear me, and I can talk to them and persuade them. And I'm also talking to their folks back home, and what I say to their folks back home will help the people back home to have confidence in me. They will not fear that Sammy's fate is in the hands of somebody who doesn't give a damn and who will put him up the paddle without a creek. His fate is in the hands of somebody who's not going to waste lives and who knows what he's up to. And morale is greatly strengthened by the proper reporting of what is going on the front. And therefore, if you, the BBC, want to do that job more thoroughly than you have been doing and you need facilities, very well, we can have them. And so we were going into Europe as a reporting team for the BBC, not just 2 strong as we'd been in North Africa, but 32 strong. And we were going to have our reporters with on each of the 5 beaches, with the British troops, with the Canadian troops, with the American troops, with those in the air, with those at sea, with those in the merchant ships who were bringing in the supplies, with all the engineers who were building the Mulberry Harbours and so forth. It really was the most thoroughly integrated reporting operation that the BBC up to then had ever undertaken, or any other broadcasting organisation. And furthermore, we were taking with us recording equipment of varying kinds, so that we could get with microphones, with the really portable stuff, right up into the action, which we'd never been able to do before, and our own transmitters going with us everywhere, so that we could be in instantaneous touch with London the whole time. All this had been agreed in readiness for the big D-Day operation. What we had to do now was to train our men to make use of all these facilities. They were carefully chosen. They were all good broadcasters, like Winfred Vaughan Thomas and so forth. Great professional broadcasters, but no battle experience. So my job for the couple of months before the landing in Normandy, with Richard Dimbleby, and we were the two people who had to do it mostly, was to train these new people who were going to go in with us when the Normandy day arrived. And so we had intensive training. This was all done, or mostly done, down at Evesham, where the BBC had a country headquarters. And we finished up with a very well-trained group of people. And I found, personally, after the Normandy landings, that I knew, and I knew my colleagues were in the same position, I knew far more about the army and army tactics and army procedures and how to make the army work than the people who were assigned to us from public relations branch of the army as what were called conducting officers. We had to tell the conducting officers what this meant, what that meant, how you got to speak to this general, what the manoeuvres meant, how they were being conducted and so forth. They were really civilians in uniform. We were halfway on towards being soldiers by then, if not more. And the fact that we rapidly became known to the military command was also terribly important. The great trouble about the Falklands war, wasn't a war, was it? The Falklands hostilities was that they were sprung upon us, and the newspapers and the broadcasters had to send out people who had no training of any kind. I mean, they were literally taken off what they call the cab rank. I mean, you were the reporter of the day on duty, right, then you're jolly well going out to the Falklands and you report tonight at Portsmouth and you have no military training at all. Well, that did not happen for Normandy. We went into Normandy as a very well-trained team, and we as I say, we had people wherever there was likely to be action. We had people who, Chester Wilmot went in with the glider forces, Guy Byam went in with the paratroops. There was absolutely no aspect of that operation that we hadn't foreseen. We'd been taken completely into confidence about it all and prepared for. At first, we were an uncoordinated group until the various fronts, the five fronts in Normandy, linked up together and formed a coordinated 60-mile front. We were a bunch of separately distributed people, but as soon as possible we got together and formed our own little headquarters and operated out from there. We found that in order to make use of our first transmitter came ashore on the 19th of June in 1944, just as the gale was which destroyed the first Mulberry Harbour was beginning to blow. We got our transmitter ashore. We took it inland 5 miles to the little village of Crewe, C-R-E-U-L-L-Y in Normandy, and set it up there and found that it could provide a wonderfully clear signal right through to London. We had supplied with the transmitter a tent which we thought might be used as a studio, but in practice, of course, that was a mistake, because the walls of the tent couldn't keep out the extraneous noise. And wherever you went in the bridgehead, which had no depth to it at all, of course you had a great deal of din going on the whole time. I mean, if it wasn't explosion of artillery, it was taking off of typhoons and very noisy aircraft not very far away and so on. So after one day in the tent trying to broadcast from there as a studio, we gave up hope on that. And we took over with military approval and support the turret room of a chateau in this village of Crewe, right in the heart of the village. And the turret room was right at the top of the tower. And we converted it into a makeshift studio. And if you go to Crewe today, you'll find it's a little BBC museum, and all our photographs are displayed there, and a great message from Monty and all the rest of it. The great advantage of this location was that we were right alongside Monty. Our chateau looked out upon, half a mile away, another chateau, and that was Monty's headquarters. And he practically regarded us as part of his HQ. Though I may say, that as chap in charge of the operation there, I always was most careful to make it plain to everybody that we were not part of his HQ, because we were not. We were still independent people, as it were. We were not people who merely reported what Monty told us to report. Now, this improvised studio is remarkable, really, because we kept it going 24 hours a day, and we threw it open to all the broadcasters, not just the BBC team, but also the Americans all used it. It's the only way that the American broadcasting people could report back to America, come back to our studio and do it. They had no means of their own. So did, of course, the Australians, the Canadians, the New Zealanders, any other English-speaking, or Indian, well, it doesn't matter about the language, any other allied reporter who wanted to use it, including, of course, the Free French reporters and the reporters who were speaking to Germany itself and to the occupied countries of Europe in their own languages. One continuous stream of journalists climbing the worn circular worn steps of this circular stairway up to the turret room in this little chateau. It wasn't a little chateau, it was a fair-sized chateau, in order to speak through via London to the rest of the world. There's quite a historic little centre there. And from there we covered the whole of the Normandy operation. And as long as it lasted, I mean, until the Battle of Normandy was won, we were able to keep that going continuously in really rather an adventurous way. I mean, I remember getting a signal from London one day from the religious broadcasting people who said, any chance at all for a Sunday morning religious service of broadcasting a service from the front, a field service? So I went to Monty and said, what do you think about this? And he said, oh, you must do it. It'd be wonderful for morale. Let's do it. Do it here. He said, do it here, right outside my chateau. There was a field there adjoining it, so we took over this field. And through his mechanism, I had no such mechanism. I mean, all the units in the front were notified, and every unit in the front sent back a group of chaps to take part in this service. They all assembled in this field. And I got the Canon Hughes, who was the chaplain in chief, to preach, and I got a padre called Steele, who was the deputy chaplain, to take the service. And I mean, little things like thinking, well, now how on earth you get singing going properly and making it sound good over the air and that sort of thing. We ought to have an organ of some kind. Where are we going to find an organ? And I didn't know what the hell to do about this. And it was Padre Steele who said, look, tell you what we can do. I take around with me a little portable harmonium thing. Almost every padre does when he's taking services in the line. And he said, if we could amplify that, it would make a pretty good old noise. And to amplify it, why don't we get hold of one of these propaganda vans that we have, which is shouting propaganda across the lines to the Germans, telling them to come in and surrender. And why don't we stick its microphone on top of this harmonium? And when the harmonium plays in the field, it'll sound like an organ. And by God, it did, you know. So we had a marvellous service there, absolutely terrific. We had to be awfully careful about announcing it and that sort of thing in case the Germans found us and bombed us. So we were rather deceitful about where it was located and all that. Not, I won't say deceitful, but we were very careful not to give any indication of it. But we were able to do quite adventurous little things like that and really make people at home feel that they were close to what was happening, close to the fighting and close to the life of our troops who were fighting those battles in Normandy. And then, of course, we had the marvellous conclusion of the campaign in Normandy, and it happened, it fell to me to report it, actually, but I'm talking about the collapse of the German 7th Army and the Falaise, the drive-through to Falaise, and then the utter disruption of the entire German forces and all the booty they left behind and all the wreckage and the havoc that was involved. Marvellous, marvellous stories, absolutely wonderful battle stories. But I think we were really able to bring home with a high degree of vividness. There was no television in those days. People went to the cinemas and saw newsreels. But I believe that radio was at its peak just then. I mean, and radio, which is a medium exercising such a tremendous influence on the imagination of people, you know, played very much on the imagination of people at home, and we worked on that very hard in our reporting, trying to frame our words and conduct our affairs in such a way that the imagination of any listener was stimulated, and with his mind's eye, at any rate, he could picture the scene and could participate to some degree in it. It had never been tried before, but it did seem to work. And, of course, following the Battle of Normandy, we had to pursue the Germans and move with the armies across Europe. We sent one great arm around to Paris, one of our reporting teams with the Americans who raced around for the liberation of Paris. We had another team going through to Brussels, and the third team, which I went with, actually, going around the northern coast of Europe along the English Channel. Often I found myself the liberator of all sorts of little townships, because the Germans were known to be repeating. They were pulling out and going, and in each little town a great reception was being prepared for the Allied forces, the British sweeping in behind them. The British weren't sweeping in behind them. The British were concentrating their main forces on Paris and Brussels. But there was the little BBC van and a BBC reporter coming through and having to receive numerous van d'honneur and making speeches and assuring them that they were liberated, and getting them to sing the Marseillaise in the main square, and sending it back to London to be broadcast back to them so that they could hear themselves, all that sort of thing. I'd wanted to do that, as I said earlier, because I wanted to be there for Dieppe. I also very much wanted to be doing the northern coastline of Brussels, of Belgium, because I had been at one stage when I was a schoolmaster, I'd done travel courier work, taking people around the battlefields of World War I. And I wanted to get back in those areas and see what had happened there. And that was very fascinating stuff. And it's a rapid advance. I mean, it was you were covering, I don't know, 50 miles a day or more, and it was a lot of space. And as I say, held up all the time by people who wanted to celebrate with you the great victory.
Could I ask you there about this reception by the liberated population? Because the dispatches of the time seem to be uniform in getting across a message that people were delighted to be liberated. But was this really the whole picture, or were there people who were angry because of the destruction, or who cold-shouldered the Allies?
It was very true in Belgium that the reception was wholehearted and total, and no resentments at all. In France, Montgomery said to me once, "Do you really think the French want to be liberated?" Because it was half-hearted, and that was partly because of, certainly, that northern France, the coastline area, had been pretty well devastated. War had passed over them in a very brutal way, particularly in Normandy. I mean, the Battle of Normandy, of course, caused immense destruction in Normandy, and it was resented, there's no doubt about it. And I think that it's true that many French people had got used to the Germans and had come to say, well, after all, they are our neighbours, they're next to us in Europe and all the rest of it, and isn't it foolish for us, to be... don't they mean more to us than the British, who are over there across the water and never really think much about us in peacetime? The French did not show all that much joy at our. I'm not saying this is a universal experience, but there were large numbers of French people who were not enthusiastic about us. Large numbers of French people were. I mean, to be quite frank, there were plenty of French who were delighted to see us, but quite a considerable number who didn't care much.
But Montgomery commented on this.
He did to me personally, privately, yes. But in Belgium, it was 100%. Absolutely. I didn't meet anybody in the whole of Belgium who wasn't delighted to get rid of the Germans. And they were terribly scared. When it came to everybody was grieved that the Arnhem operation was not a total success. It was not a total failure either, by any manner of means. I mean, we did a most remarkable advance at high speed across Holland. And we got as far as Nijmegen and secured our advance, and the Germans, although they tried very hard, never drove us back from Nijmegen. But we did not get to Arnhem, which was our ultimate target. It was one bridge too far, as Cornelius Ryan has said. That worried, I think, particularly the Belgians. They felt that they were, until we were right out of Belgian territory and well advanced into Holland and Germany. They were not really secure. And then, of course, in the very last month of the year, 1944, the Germans put through their counterattack the Battle of the Bulge in the Ardennes. And for a few days, there was immense anxiety. Indeed, it lasted more than a few days in Belgium, because they thought that if the Germans really succeeded in fighting their way back into Belgium, large numbers of them would pay the price of having been enthusiastic at seeing them go, which is very true. I was I was giving some lectures in Brussels over the Christmas period in the Palais des Beaux-Arts. A series of lectures was mounted by people whose names were likely to be known to the Belgians, and mine, because they were all listening to the BBC all the time, was well known. And the questions which came pouring at me after these lectures, I mean, after I'd spoken, were all indicative of, are we or are we not going to find the Germans back here again? I remember actually going to Monty and saying, now, look, I'm getting these questions. What can I say in reply? He said, you give them my assurance that they're never going to see the Germans back here again. And that's from me personally. So I was able to give that assurance every time, and it always brought up a great cheer. And, of course, he was quite right. But it was the Americans themselves who, although they had suffered from the German blow in the Ardennes and had let the Germans through, their line was broken, and the Germans poured through it, and the Germans had a successful advance in the first few days. It was the Americans who, with great bravery and immense courage, really immense courage, in the face of the most bitter and terrible weather that I'd experienced in my life, I think, fought back and reversed the situation. Our own troops, the 21 Army Group troops, did a remarkable job of regrouping themselves, moving down from the northern areas of the front where they'd been located to form a blocking force on the west banks of the River Meuse. If the Germans had got across the River Meuse, it would have been very difficult to stop them getting through. What they allegedly wanted to do was to get through to Antwerp and thus cut off all the Allied forces which had advanced beyond Antwerp. Well, if they never got across the Meuse, they never even got to the Meuse, and it was the Americans who stopped them. But Monty had lined all his 21st Army Group crowd right along the west banks of the river, so that even if they got to the Meuse and attempted a crossing, they would have found it almost impossible to get through. Monty was very confident all the time. He was given, by Eisenhower, command of the American armies in the northern part of General Bradley's 12th Army Group front. This was because the Germans, having punched their hole through, had split Bradley's front, and Bradley was in the southern half and out of touch, except by radio, with his troops in the north. And Eisenhower properly thought that coordinated response to this German attack required that those two armies, the American, 1st and 9th, I think, I'm not quite sure, 1st and 9th, I'm pretty sure, would be best put under Monty's command temporarily, because Monty was up there in the north and had, of course, the whole of 21 Army Group behind him as well, so that if there was trouble, Monty could produce a coordinated response to it. In fact, those two American armies, under Monty's command as group commander, but really taking their instructions from their own army commanders, were able to restore the position and knock in the bulge that destroy the bulge that the Germans had managed to quite a big bulge. I mean, no small bulge, very big bulge, but the walls of it crumbled under the pressure from the north and the south. Patton was driving up from the south, and Monty, with these two American armies, was driving in on it from the north. So the bulge was completely destroyed, and everything in it was destroyed. And this was the last great German attempt, of course, to re-establish any sort of German control of military affairs there from then on. Although they put up a great rearguard resistance, their situation crumbled progressively. Monty, yes?
Sorry, you were probably going to say it, but you were telling me earlier about Monty's
press conference. Yes, it was a press conference. Monty, when the situation was restored, felt a great desire to in some way or other, bring home to the world at large the fact that this had been a great coordinated allied response to a very grave German threat. As it had been, I mean, although the British troops hardly fired a shot, I mean, that they were effectively deployed in case of very serious consequences from the breakthrough. And Monty himself, as I said, had brought two American armies under command and had directed them. It had been a great Allied response to a very dangerous German move. And Monty wanted to underline this fact publicly. Well, he didn't ask me for a broadcast, and I think if he had, I should have tried very hard to advise him as to how he expressed himself over it. But what he did was he called a general press conference. I may say he'd consulted Churchill in advance about this, and Churchill also thought that to hold this up to public exposure as a great Allied effort was a good idea and would strengthen the Allied cause. He called his press conference, and because he was so clumsy in putting over what he was trying to say, that he was taken by the Americans, and not unfairly, as claiming the credit for the fact that the German attack had been repulsed so effectively, which he was not entitled to do. The credit for that really went to the American 101 Airborne Division, which was at the very pivot of the whole attack at a place called Bastogne, and which had been cut off, and whose request for surrender from the Germans. The Germans had sent in a request for surrender, and the general in command there had sent back one word, nuts. Nuts. They were the people to whom the credit was due, and the American troops, the American forces, had fought the battle and had won it. And they felt deeply aggrieved that Monty appeared to be claiming the credit. And their complaints were conveyed by Patton to General Bradley, who was the commander-in-chief of the army group, who was very well aware of the situation himself. Bradley went to Eisenhower, who also felt very strongly about the thing. Eisenhower went to Churchill about it. Churchill was worried about it.